Just kind of a point of reference as we're getting ready to get started. I did something in ignorance last night, and I didn't realize it until one of you came up and told me. And I can't even remember now which slide it was, but do you remember that little sweet picture of the elephants exchanging a bouquet of flowers? Did you happen to notice they both had tusks? And hey, I only use, I know about computer ethics, I only use free to use and share public domain images, so that's kind of the extent that I vet, you know, make sure they're large enough so they don't pixelate on the screen. I didn't think that I was facilitating some kind of pride picture, but apparently I was. If you haven't noticed, the flowers were all different colors, so live and learn.
You were upset because I Googled it.
That was the breed I used, I'm pretty sure. So, somebody's cynical. I'm just kidding. Yes,
the elephants have much larger.
Okay. Who knew you would come to a marriage seminar and learn about elephant tusks? Or Renaissance fairs, man. The stories we'll be able to tell. All right, well, we're going to get started in our next session. And this particular one, as you can see on the screen, is balancing children and careers in your marriage. I gave out the sheets last night, and I really appreciate the way that you participated, and you gave me some very good and thoughtful answers. I appreciate your candor. You know, I don't guess there is a marriage where there aren't some issues to have to deal with. So if you, as you were identifying some of those things, felt like you were alone, certainly as I peel through that, some of those issues are more pronounced than others or would require some more action or elaboration on than others do. But certainly we're all struggling to try to overcome the things that we're dealing with in this life, and that plays out in the interpersonal arena of marriage. Where two lives are brought together and we're trying to navigate through life together as husband and wife. So we'll refer to some of that before we close today. I think about some of the men in the Bible who were a success in their career. I mean, and really had the esteem of their peers and even in some cases of an entire nation. I mean, perhaps the one that comes to your mind first in the Bible is one who was a career success would be David. I mean, it was remarkable. He was a military hero. He was a national hero. He was even a spiritual hero. But he was a parental goat. Perhaps there's no single father that had more carnage in the wake and was more responsible for a lot of that than David was. Now, here's the man after God's own heart. And he struggled in that regard. Eli. A direct descendant of Aaron, the high priest of the people of God, in such a position and had a nurturing side, didn't he? As he had Samuel come into his home, and yet he was a failure when it came to Hophni and Phinehas. Then I think about Samuel, who perhaps received some negative example from the parental guidance of Eli. And as we look at him, we see that he himself also failed in that regard. But then let's kind of flip the coin. What do we know about Saul, the predecessor of David? What when you think about Saul, what do you typically think of? He's the first king, and let's describe his reign. What was it like? All right, if we want to summarize it, and if we think back on the totality of it, there was some early success. There was the humility, right, with which he began his reign. He was hiding among the baggage. And yet, as he slowly comes into that position, pride comes into play. And impatience and a lot of other things that were amounting to disobedience. And as a result of that, he was a failure. Spiritually, he was a failure nationally. But not necessarily that they lost the battles, but because of the kind of leadership he provided. But I don't know, and he wasn't a perfect father for sure, but he had a good boy. You try to think about those who could put that all together. It's not easy to do, is it? And I don't want to just focus on the fathers, but moms and dads, as we look at the responsibility that God has given to us, and we look at the spheres in which we operate, There is a career side. There is an occupational side, a work in our lives that we're to do. And then there's also the parenting that we're to do. And alongside of that, God expects us to build and to grow a healthy relationship with one another as husbands and wives. I don't know if you ever heard the AP story about the company employee who sent a dirty joke to 6,000 other employees. It's very interesting. The perpetrator accidentally sent it beyond his little sphere of cohorts. But did you know he worked for the FCC? And the FCC is charged, as you know, with setting decency limits on media outlets. And so one who was supposed to protect those things was guilty of the very thing that he was supposed to be guarding against. You know, you've heard the jokes, right? Who has the worst pipes? Plumbers. I'm not saying that it's true, but that's what they say, you know. Plumbers, I'm sorry if there's any of you here. But they say plumbers have the worst pipes. And as a preacher, I've heard the jokes about how preachers' kids are the worst, and I are one. So I gave some good fodder for a lot of folks when I was growing up. And you think about how one who's, as a preacher, is to have certain expectations with regard to what he does for a living. But so often we see that there's some difficulty in his personal life. But you know, preachers aren't the only ones that deal with that. It's not their exclusive concern. Each and every one of us who are married with both children and a career face similar challenges. Can we succeed in every one of these areas? Can we succeed as parents? Can we succeed professionally while we look at that personal relationship of marriage? Now, I see we have some folks donning their colors today, Auburn and Alabama in the same room. It's amazing. All things are possible in Christ. I'm a Georgia fan, so see, we got half the SEC. Huh? Go Dogs, that's right. See, a woman of culture among us. But oh, never mind. Out in Denver, we're a pro city. We don't have much interest in the college sport, and there's a reason why. It's been since this guy, when you talk about the glory days for Colorado football, the other way to put that is the Bill McCartney era. It's about 12, 13 years. From 1982 to 1994, you have a guy who comes in and he restores a program that had never had any national prominence at all. Won or was the co-champion in 1990 in college football. Finished in the top 10 several times. He was a high achiever. But I found it very interesting. He, in 1994, in what really took the Colorado sports world by surprise, he announced his resignation. In the prime of his coaching life, I found it interesting, he said why. He said, I'm leaving coaching, and I'm going to take a whole year to reevaluate my priorities. Is God first? Is my family second? And is my work third? Now, out of this, he did something that created a positive environment in the religious world as a whole. There are certainly some doctrinal issues with it, but you're familiar with Promise Keepers. That was what he did with that time off, trying to produce a wholesome picture of male leadership in the home. And that certainly is something that's needed in our society. What a refreshing and what an unusual decision from a person of character and influence to have the priorities in the order that they should be. God is to be first, family is to be second, and career is to be third. And I'm not suggesting every man or woman quit or retire from the job. For most of us, that's an impossibility to even consider that. But there's a balance that has to exist, and that's what we're talking about today, is striking the balance in those regards. So the overarching question is, what can we do to balance children and careers in our marriage? I want to give you some suggestions that at least get the ball rolling and perhaps get us to thinking in terms of this that will help us as we try to keep that very tenuous and hard to maintain balance in our marriages. Number one, do not overextend and overcommit yourself. Easy to say, hard to do. I want to take you to Exodus chapter 18. If you have your Bibles, look over there with me, verse 13 through 18. Exodus chapter 18. We'll begin our reading at verse 13. It came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning until the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw that all that he did to the people, he said, "What is this thing that you do to the people? Why do you sit yourself alone, and all the people stand by you from morning until evening?" And Moses said unto his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. And when they have a matter, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make them know the statutes of God and His laws." And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, "The thing that you do, surprisingly, is not good. You will surely wear away, you and this people that are with you. For this thing is too heavy for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself alone." Now, we're told how this affected Moses. How did it affect Moses? And oftentimes when we talk about leadership, we say, what's the impact of this kind of work ethic sometimes on the leader? What words do we use? Burnout. You're worn out. Just frazzled, whatever the synonym is. But it's interesting. How did this affect Zipporah and the boys, Gershom and Eliezer? You see, back in Exodus chapter 18, verse 2 through 4, the Bible says simply that he sent them away. So certainly there was an impact on Moses. And I realized the culture was different and Eastern mindset versus Western mindset. And so there's some things that don't correlate. But you got to think that day after day, from the morning to the evening, it's wearing him out. And where is Moses' impact on his boys and on his wife? Because they're not there. We're sure that Moses had allowed himself to be overcommitted as we look at what happens in Exodus chapter 18. I don't know why we struggle with saying no. I think it's born of some good stuff, right? Why would you not want to say no? You want to be dependable. You want people to be able to rely on you, right? You want to be able to use the skill set that God has given you in the most productive and the best way. You realize that there's a finite window, and you only have so much time to have an impact through the skills that you have honed and you've developed. But what happens when we overcommit ourselves and extend ourselves too far in our career? What happens? It all gets watered down. Okay? Now, when we say all, maybe not the work part. Maybe you have the accolades, the respect, the admiration of everybody that you work with. And you've heard the old adage, and I forget who exactly it was, but supposedly it was a Boston lawyer who was laying on his, or was observing a situation. He said he was the first one to say that no one laying on their deathbed said, "I wished I'd spent more time at the office." But so often, just even when the nest gets empty, through the focus that's so intense on work, you have particularly men, but sometimes women, who have regret because they were so focused on the commitments and not saying no on the job that it was their family that suffered. You know, we can't effectively meet the needs of our children or our mate when we're in absentia. How do you obey Ephesians chapter 5 and Ephesians chapter 6 when you're never around? You see, so we've got to balance these expectations and these commitments with those other commitments that we assume when we came into the marriage relationship and we together had children. So how can we keep from overcommitting and overextending ourselves? How do we offset that? What do we do? Let me give you some answers. Have some built-in schedule limitations. Now listen, this is going to take effort on your part. This is not a magic pill that you put down and it all solves itself. This is action you got to take. But there have to be built-in limitations. There has to be a balance in budgeting for your time, your marriage, and your children. And let me say this, usually you won't be guilty of spending too much time with your wife or too much time with your children. It's going to be your career. You need to have a set time with your family and your wife and your weekly and your annual calendar and be as inflexible with that as possible. Ask yourself, does it ever happen that you say to work responsibilities, "I can't do that because I have an existing responsibility"? You don't have to spell it out. It's not their business necessarily, but you say, "I already have a commitment," and that commitment is in your home. So often we'll say to family, "I can't do this. I know we already had it planned because I have this thing at work." See, that's where the principle comes in. Set in built-in limitations. Number two, do not try and to keep up with the Joneses' kids' social activity schedule. Does it seem like you practice a whole lot more now? Now, I don't know. It depends on how old you are. I remember when we were growing up and playing sports, It didn't seem to be so all-consuming. Of course, we didn't have travel teams and all the other things, but it seems like we can create a situation where we are consumed with our kids' activities, and sometimes it's a peer pressure thing that exists. And we want to make sure that our kids aren't losing out on the experience. And so there's this frenetic from this thing to that thing that goes 12 months out of the year, all the way through their upbringing. And it's interesting that in the summer of 2006, they did a survey of 1,800 parents in San Mateo, California. It found that 40% of them stated that their greatest concern was the stress and pressure on their kids to succeed by taking harder classes, participating in more after-school activities, and striving for success at every step. But the question is, who is often behind this stress? It's parents pushing their kids to build college resumes or living vicariously through their children's activities or trying to save face with family and friends and neighbors and coworkers. Do not allow peer pressure to skew your priorities as parents. You get one shot to raise your children. And you should do so in the way that best ensures not only a normal and well-adjusted life, but more importantly, gives them the best spiritual preparation possible. We can get so consumed in our children's schedules as parents that we neglect to be good husbands and wives to one another. Our lives revolve around their calendar to such a degree that we're strangers who are raising kids together. And so we need to make sure that we do what's healthy and helps our kids to be raised normal, but not so to the expense of particularly our marriage. But then also we need to learn the skill and grace of enlisting. Like Moses, don't try to do it all by yourself. You know, great leadership is supposed to be bound up in delegating and mentoring and being able to pass off some of the responsibilities and not trying to do it all yourself. You know, in the work environment, it may be that you can do it better than somebody else, but you pass that along so as to be able to produce some peace in your own circumstances, but also to help them to grow. But then number two, a second suggestion, is honor your commitments. I've stressed how we don't want to be overcommitted, but when you get married, you have a commitment there. You stood before God and witnesses, and you said that you were going to do certain things. You were going to love and honor one another in sickness and health, for richer or poorer, for better or worse, until death do you part. You bound yourself with that. And then the two of you desired and planned to have children, and God blessed you with that. You remember those moments of intensity as ladies, you were having those children. And together you became parents. And then you've got a responsibility to work. Success comes in taking seriously your responsibility to fulfill all of these roles. In all three areas, the Lord speaks seriously to us about honoring our commitments. Ephesians chapter 5 and 1 Peter chapter 3 as spouses. Deuteronomy chapter 6, Proverbs 22 and verse 6, Ephesians 6 verse 1 through 4, and Colossians 3 verse 21 as parents, and Ephesians chapter 6 and Colossians chapter 4 as employees or workers. These are God-given instructions, and so we cannot slack off with regard to those. I want you to remember something that was observed by a man by the name of Michael Weed. He says, family life cannot be neglected. Avoid the mistaken rationale that says those who understand, that is, one's own family, are expected to sacrifice for those who don't understand, co-workers. This thinking is destructive. Don't neglect the commitments that you have, but realize you have more than a work commitment. You have a commitment first in earthly relationships to your spouse. Number three. Remember your purpose. Remember why you're here. You are here to take care of your responsibilities physically. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8, it's in the context of talking about widows. But the Apostle Paul says, if any man provides not for his own, especially those of his own house, this man is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So we have a responsibility there. It's part of our purpose. But it's not our only purpose. And there are things that can distract us from our spiritual purpose. This is not exhaustive, but it includes the internet, your hobbies, worry, bitterness, difficult adversarial people. We can get so busy putting out fires and addressing the urgent and the immediate on the job that we lose effectiveness in our marriage and in our parenting. But then number four, the one I want to spend some time on, is watch your relationships. Now, God made us social creatures. He knew that it was not going to be good for us to be isolated and to be alone. And so he created these relationships, and he made the family the building block of society, the building block of government, the building block of the church. And so God knew that you and I were going to need these relationships in our lives. Yes, there are those like the Apostle Paul that was able to make it alone single in Christ. But so often we have this desire to have someone in our life, to have a spouse and to have children. But in those relationships, there's some things that can taint and get in the way. Let me mention a few of them. Number one is triangulation. Cloud and Townsend discussed this, and here's another book, Henry Cloud and John Townsend. It's called Boundaries. It's an excellent book. They talk about this principle of triangulation. Anybody know what that means? Triangulation is when you bring a third person into a two-person situation. All right, so a third and outside party is brought into something that belongs between two people. So can you think of some examples where triangulation can happen in relationships? Who's the third person? Who can the third person be? Well, that's the positive example, but the triangulation here is something that interferes with good relationships. This is another person on earth. In-laws. Now, I'm not telling in-law jokes. I didn't bring it up. Somebody else did. All right, but... All right, so it can be an in-law. Has it ever happened in history? Probably. Yes, it has. All right, so we got in-law. What else? A close friend. Okay. Okay, so somebody of the opposite sex. All right. And that could be for either sex. It could be a co-worker. All right. Somebody said it. It was muffled, but kids. Kids can be that third point on the triangle. So here's how it breaks down. A wife, person A, goes to a friend, person C, for something that she should go to her husband, person B, for. A father makes a child a confidant and becomes closer to the child than his wife. A husband, person A, goes to a female co-worker, person C, to complain about problems with his wife, person B. Do not allow yourself to be pulled into a triangle. Don't be the third point on the triangle, because it's not healthy. It's not productive. When you supplant the role, particularly what we're talking about that should exist between the husband and the wife, it's damaging. And I know sometimes it happens so slowly and so subtly, but you begin to think about the problems in all those triangulation situations that we mentioned. What's the problem when the mother or father-in-law get to be too integrated into the relationship? It's a biblical problem, right? What's the biblical problem? It's that old leaving and cleaving thing. It's leaving, cleaving, and going back. You know, it's not supposed to be that way. Can I tell the story about the plate? All right. I wasn't going to tell that one. It's not really that bad. It was bad at the time. Well, we had been married less than a year, and Kathy and I had our first serious fight we'd ever had. And she was crying, and she got on the phone and called her dad. And she said, "I want to come home." And he said, did he hit you or hurt you?" She said, "Oh, no. "Did he cheat on you?" "No." She said, "Well, honey, we broke your plate. You're going to have to stay there." And she, you know, at the time we thought, boy, this is, you know, she thought it was perhaps the worst thing in the world, but it turned out okay. I'm thankful that he said that. What if he had become the third point on that triangle? Oh, honey, I knew he was a scoundrel from the very beginning. He might have. Hey, after our first date, she went home and told him that she was going to marry me. And he said, "Honey, don't accept the first old fish that comes along in the water." You say it better. The first fish that comes in the sea. And that's what I was. And I just knew a good thing when I saw it. But anyway, he did not put himself as the third point in that triangle. That's so important. You know, we're getting that point in our lives where we have our oldest son's going to get married in about three and a half months. Hard to believe, less than that, about 3 months. And you look and you care about your kids, and it's difficult to see them as they go out on their own and they try to make decisions. They're going to blow it. They're going to make some bad choices. But don't allow yourself to become the third point on that triangle. What about some of the other examples we gave? What about the co-worker? What's the problem with that?
They don't have the values, morals, and life goals.
More likely than not, they're going to be coming from a worldly perspective. And what does the world say? Hey, if it doesn't work for you, bail out. You know, hey, you deserve better than that. You know, that whole consumer idea, and it feeds that and says, hey, you don't take that. And what do they have? Remember last night? What do they have? They have your decidedly one-sided point of view. They probably don't even know your spouse. And in some cases, might have some more sympathy if they did. They'd have a more balanced view. So what about the child?
You put them in the wrong position. That's not a position a child should be in. To be confidant to a parent.
That's right.
That maybe later on in later stages of life, but not in that situation.
And there can be circumstances where there's serious stuff to deal with. But just remember, they're always going to be the child, no matter how young or old they are, but especially in those formidable years, they're not emotionally prepared for that. And it comes off as manipulation. It's not really helpful. It's not good for either party when that happens. Yes, sir. They become a pawn. And, of course, the child has leverage now. Because children are very, very smart, and they know how to utilize that to their advantage. But it also becomes a point of leverage for the spouse who maybe is using or are involving themselves in that triangulation so that the other spouse is isolated. You see, it becomes a problem.
And it perpetuates bad behavior to a next generation, and they don't learn how to properly handle marital conflict.
Right. So there you go. They don't have the know-how to talk about breaking the plate. They foster that. All right, so it's a learned behavior thing. But see, that's what we're talking about. When we're talking about balancing children and careers, this is one of those things that so often comes up. And that can't be allowed to happen. It's not healthy. A third party threatens a warm, secure environment. And marital love requires a lot of safety and for intimacy to grow. All right, so don't lose your relationship to triangulation. Let's talk more specifically. Don't lose your relationship to your kids. We've talked about the dangers of a me-first marriage. But what about a child-first marriage? How does this happen? How do couples have child-first... And by the way, does it happen? Okay. I know it does. You love your kids so much. As I say, that was one of the things that came up on the sheet last night, so I know it happens. So it happens because we do. We brought them into this world. We're proud of them. Okay. Yep, that's exactly right.
Most people now, especially, and I hear it pretty often, they want their kids to be their friends.
Oh, that's good.
And they forget their role as a parent to that child.
That's a great point. And children need to nurture and develop that structure and authority that's not found in a more peer setup of a relationship. That's an excellent point. So any other ways that this happens? We love them so much. We want them to be our friends. How else does it happen that we put our kids first before our marriage? Hey, by the way...
When the spouses are in isolation, when they're absent, you get that basic Maslow's hierarchy needs from those children.
All right, so it fills the hole that's there. All right, because we have emotional needs. We have talk about the different needs, the hierarchy of needs, then we're going to fill that in somehow. And you remember last night, that's why it's so important. And I do recommend, of all the resources, this is one of the ones at the top, is Dennis and Barbara Rainey Staying Close. Because, and I didn't make this point last night, the natural tendency we think in our romantic, naive state when we're younger, we think that we're just going to always be in love and it's going to be so natural that we're going to just be close. They make a powerful point. The tendency is to go apart. You have to work to stay together. You see, it's just not instinct. It's not base. It's not natural. It involves intervention on your part, work that you put in, you see. How do people lose their marriages to their children? That's the question. Marriage is not meant to be marriage is meant to be the foundation of the family. It's the core relationship that precedes children and all else that happens in the parent-child relationship. We fall in love with each other before we fall in love with our kids. Our children rely on the stability and the security of our own marriage for their stability and their security. That was the point that was made. But too often in our current culture, the children own the parents. It's true. Children dictate their own bedtimes, where they sleep, and too often that's in the parents' bed until they're much too old. They set their own rules of conduct, like curfew, and when and if to do homework, and how much screen time that they get, and things like that. Rules that build orderly society, like don't interrupt adult conversations at any time for any reason. Say please and thank you. Be taught to show courtesy for others, your peers and adults, and respecting parents' privacy are often lost. So what about in our relationships? How do we know? How do we know if the kids own the marriage or if we own the marriage? William Doherty gives a 7-point question, or 7-question test. Here's how you know. Here's 7 factors, and just do a mental test in your mind. Number 1, 5 nights out of 7. Your pre-adolescent kids go to bed whenever they want, and it's usually well after 9 p.m. Number 2, when you finally get a moment with your spouse, your kids ask for things or demand your attention, and you find it easier to give in to them instead of asking them to wait until you're done. Number 3, you haven't had a night out alone together in a month, and you can't even remember the last one before that. Number 4, the lock on your bedroom door has grown rusty from disuse. Number 5, your downtime as a couple is always family time, watching a movie together, out or at home, or going to kids' activities, etc. Number 6, when the choice in the moment is between talking to your spouse about their day or doing something or playing with the kids, you almost always choose the kids. And number 7, when you finally finished your kids' chores for the day and your spouse wants to sit and relax with you, you can't resist doing something related to the kids, quote, while we talk. All right, so how do we get our marriages back from our kids? Because I believe that there are a lot of folks who are kind of stuck in that zone, dealing with that difficulty of trying to be marriage first. And you know, the thing is, when you're marriage first oriented, it's going to benefit your kids. I used to listen to a lady on the radio. You might have Dr. Laura Schlesinger. And she had a lot of good things to say. She really did. But she was dead wrong on something. She said, you always put your kids before your marriage. I don't agree with that. I don't think it's biblical at all. So how do you get your marriage back from your children? Number 1, remind yourself that marriage is the foundation of your family and your kids' security. Marriage is the foundation. That's number 1. Remember that. Number 2, remember that your kids are better fighters for their needs than you and your mate are for fighting for the needs of your marriage. And I don't know if there's an exception to that. They're resilient. They're good at that. Number 3, limit your family's outside activities so that you'll have 2 things that are growing rarer these days. Time to hang out as a family and time to hang out as a couple. Number 4, have fixed bedtimes for your children. That gives you off-duty time. You're not always doing the parent thing. I know you're a parent 24/7, but having that fixed bedtime allows you to have couple time. And you say, well, how do we do that? You do it. And you enforce it. And it's going to be, let me tell you right now, it's going to be rough. If you're not used to doing that, it's going to be hard. But if you stick with it, I promise you, it may get worse before it gets better, but it gets better. Number 5, don't let your children interrupt your every conversation. Number 6, remember that some conversations aren't to be had in front of the children. So you need a quiet place, a private place where you can go. Number 7, or 8, I have it numbered differently. Create private time as a couple and private space that's off limits to the kids. Usually it's bedroom. Number next, get a sitter and go on regular dates. And when your children are old enough, get away on occasional weekends together. Number next, never complain about your spouse to your children. And finally, communicate to your children about what you're doing for your marriage and why you're doing it. Because that may be necessary with the other things. To let them know, look, this is what we're doing for you, but we're also doing it for us. Now, I know that may strike you as selfish, but remember, what's the foundation of the home? It's that marriage. And you see, as you strengthen that, you're strengthening the whole family bond. And on the positive side, from what Tracy said a while ago, you're teaching a functional way for them to engage in a marriage relationship and to have children and so forth. It benefits the children and not just the husband and wife. But what happens if your marriage is a kid-centered marriage all the way through? Three things happen. Number one, when the kids leave home, so does your marriage, if you're not careful. You know, we got a senior in high school. We're about to have empty nest, sort of. I guess it'll be 3 years because he'll go to school nearby is what he wants to do. But when we think about what happens in regards to that, you see folks as they send their last kid off to school. And they think, I don't know this person. What am I going to do? Number two, even if we stay together after they leave, we diminish our marriage because we've been out of focus. And number three, we can refine our marriage after our kids leave, but we'll regret the lost time and unmet potential as we role model marriage for our kids. So the idea is better is an ounce of prevention than a pound of cure. Now, if the kids have already left home, it's never too late to reinvest and to do those things, to start dating again and to go back to those roots and remember those shared memories and what brought you together in the first place. One other thing to mention, and I'm losing perspective on time. You guys aren't. You're sitting there. I'm standing. Let me mention one other thing. Watch relationships with the opposite sex that oppose the soul. A great and governing principle, and I mentioned it last night, that should govern our interaction with the opposite sex. It was told to me many years ago, is never do anything in the absence of your mate that you would not do in their presence. That's a great way for us to especially think in terms of how we relate to those of the opposite sex. The way that we touch, or the way that we speak or communicate, things that we would say, or emails that we would send, or text, or whatever it is, if we think that if my mate was here, would I do this? If we have that in the front of our mind, before we start going down that road, things will turn out differently. As Christians who care about each other, we can easily get drawn in to relationships with others that become unhealthy. And usually, they don't start nefarious. They start innocently enough. We don't have any bad intentions. The next thing we know, we're hiding things. And we're developing a relationship outside of our marriage. By the way, I don't have time to go into it, but it seems to me that Paul is warning about this in the church context in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 3 through 7. There's the way he uses that word about possess your vessel that makes a very interesting study and is talking about being sexually pure toward one another, even in a church context. Don't let admiration for another turn to lust and desire for one other than your spouse. Here's what Solomon warned in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 23. He says, for the commandment is a lamp and the law is light, and reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the flattery of the tongue of a strange woman. Lust not after her beauty in your heart, neither let her take you with her eyelids. For by means of a whorish woman, a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life. And that's the context in which he says, can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can he go upon hot coals and his feet not be burned? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife, he will be not counted unguilty. We've got to watch those relationships. Healthy relationships enrich a marriage, but those that supplant a healthy relationship create the problems like we're talking about this weekend. So let's balance that. Watch the career. Watch the children. And make sure that we keep husband and wife as the foundation of our relationship.